This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, we welcome to the program State Representative Andrea LaFontaine from Michigan's 32nd District, where I grew up, and who also chairs the very important House Natural Resources Committee, and who, with her committee colleagues, has been keeping a very vigilant eye on the Asian carp situation. Representative LaFontaine, thank you for spending some time on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you for having me.
Just after the recently released and long-awaited Army Corps of Engineers study, you introduced two resolutions in the House related to the Mississippi and Great Lakes basins. Give us a snapshot of those resolutions, why you did them, and what will be the impact.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the resolutions came as a result of the presentation that the Army Corps of Engineers came in. We did a joined House committee meeting with the Senate counterparts and with the tourism committees as well, because we realized that the threat of invasive species in Michigan impacts more than just natural resources. It reaches out into tourism, which is also a huge industry in Michigan. But we listened to the presentation from the engineers, and they provided us 8 different alternatives on what they suggest would be viable for keeping invasive species out of Michigan. So as a result of that, we came together and we decided on a solution that we think would be best, which is complete hydrologic separation, meaning just pretty much block it off and don't let anything in. However, we understand there are other impacts that need to be considered with that. We put Michigan first and foremost, because that's what we represent, and this is our great state. And I mean, we're known as the Great Lakes State, and we really need to make sure these invasive species do not enter into our waters. So it was a very bold statement for Michigan to make, but the other Great Lakes states that surround us as well, they had come to the table too, and they had some concerns. And I do believe that our Washington delegation is working very hard out in D.C. to come together with the other states as well to really figure out what the final solution will be.
Now, we've talked about this Asian carp situation on this show for several years. One thing that struck us is this major bipartisan support for this hydrologic separation of the two basins at the federal level. Are you finding the same thing working with your colleagues in the House and Senate? Is there a strong bipartisan support?
Oh, absolutely. When it comes to water in Michigan, it really goes on both sides of the aisle. We can all relate. It's something that we really want to protect. And I mean, when we looked at these different alternatives, we did have to factor in how it would affect Chicago, how it would affect Gary, Indiana, all these different places, and take those into consideration. But at the end of the day, we were able to unite and come forward as Michigan and say, this is the best proposal, and we don't want the Asian carp to get in our Great Lakes.
Now, in my reading of that report, there were 8 alternatives, one of which was to do nothing, which is not an option, and then there were 7 others. But everybody that we've talked to seems to agree that the only option that's really viable, although it may be very expensive, is the separation. Were there any other options in that report that are really worth considering?
Oh, absolutely. And there was something else, too. There was a timing component where with the hydrologic separation and looking at the cost and the time of implementing it, it really was probably about 20 to 25 years out. And we know we cannot wait that long. Like, this is a problem now, and it needs to be fixed now. So we need to look at the other options as well. And there was one that regarded the Brandon Road lock and possibly this flushing mechanism that they're going to implement in the lock. So I think that's one that we might see more movement on in the meantime.
One cause for concern, and it came out in the report a little bit, but it came out in other studies, the electronic barriers that are in place now are not as effective as some people thought. Is that true?
Oh, that's completely accurate. And I didn't actually know this until I sat down with John Allen, director of the Great Lakes, and he was informing me that sometimes when these barges are coming through the electronic barriers, the fish can get through if they're like close up at the top of the water by the barge. And I mean, I had just assumed these electronic barriors had worked, and to find that they haven't,
yes,
it makes you a lot more nervous.
Well, yeah, the Army Corps study didn't put a kind of a timeline on a lot of these sorts of things, so it's really imperative now. I mean, the next steps are these legislative steps. Your resolutions are designed to put pressure on the federal government to get moving more quickly.
Absolutely. And when we had found out that Director Cray was going out to Washington, D.C., along with John Allen, we wanted them to have this as a tool for them to use when they were out there, saying, this is what the Michigan legislature has to say. These are our thoughts. And hopefully that would spark a little fire and get them moving a little faster.
My guest is State Representative Andrea LaFontaine from the 32nd District, who chairs the Natural Resources Committee in the Michigan House. As far as the next immediate steps, I mean, we talk about the legislation. Assuming that legislative pressure at the federal and state levels continues to mount, I mean, what would be your preferred timeline on starting to deal with some of these issues of separation of basins, et cetera?
My preferred timeline would probably be yesterday, only because I feel it's such an immediate threat. And when we look at the billions of dollars that the Great Lakes bring into the state of Michigan, whether it be through anglers, commercial fishing, or tourism, this is something that needs to be protected. And this is a threat now. It's an immediate threat that needs immediate action. So the sooner the better. And, you know, I have heard other ideas of what can we do to, if they get closer, possibly make our environment more resilient towards defending them? Or can we modify any organisms or plant life that we have to kind of fight them off? So there's different thoughts being thrown around, and we're really trying to be proactive with the situation, but we definitely don't want it to be a situation where they're here, now how do we get rid of them? It's let's prevent them while we still have the chance to.
Andrea, you're a very avid hunter and fisher person yourself. Remind our listeners what these Asian carp actually do in the water that is so devastating to the tourism industry.
I think the question would be, what don't they do? Because they would do everything. They would completely decimate our Great Lakes. They would take out all other fish species, and it's something we don't want to be able to experience. I mean, you can look up the YouTube videos of Asian carp and the thing that people do. Like, I had a colleague send me a video the other day of people actually bow hunting the Asian carp flying out of the water. And I was like, this is just insane. And I hope that we don't ever have
to experience
that.
I've seen the videos of knocking people out of boats on the Chicago River and what have you. I mean, pretty dramatic stuff.
Right. And while it looks entertaining, I'm pretty sure that's not something I would want to deal with while I'm out fishing.
No. Let's turn quickly to another issue. We've got a few more minutes here, but the controversial wolf hunt in the Upper Peninsula. We've talked to Director Keith Gray of the DNR about the results of that. They seem to be pretty happy with it from a scientific management standpoint. What's your take and the members of your committee on that wolf hunt?
Absolutely. Scientific management, I think, is key, and this is allowing the experts to determine what is good for this animal species. And it's not just a wolf hunt. It is the scientific management and the threat that this animal can have on other species. So there is science that goes into determining how big of a wolf pack or wolf species is necessary. And I mean, when we heard from some people in the UP about these wolves, it just blew my mind. I mean, being from southeastern Michigan, we have coyotes. We don't have wolves. But when we hear about 100-pound dogs being attacked by these wolves, I mean, that's a threat, and that's scary. That's something I would not want to deal with in my backyard. And it was very interesting to deal with it on the committee because most of the vocal opposition were coming from areas that didn't have to face the problem. They weren't the ones that had to drive back home to the UP at night and deal with these wolves in their backyard. And I think that was a crucial component in considering how to move forward with this. And on my committee, we do have three representatives from the UP, and they were very vocal about that. And I mean, I support the wolf hunt. I wish I could have gotten a tag and gone up there and got one myself.
Apparently those wolves are pretty tough to get, though, because I think what 32 were allowed or what have you, and what 24 were taken, so they're not particularly easy to hunt.
No, not at all.
A couple other things that have been on the plate of your committee, but the Belle Isle Department of Natural Resources has become a new state park. That's been a major issue. And then the governor's initiative to connect all the trails in the state of Michigan. I imagine those are things that your committee has been looking at for some time. Your comments on those?
Oh, absolutely. I think Director Cray is doing a great job with Belle Isle and the advancements that we're making in that department. And in regards to the trails in Michigan, Michigan is starting to be known as not just the Great Lakes, but the trail state. And I noticed this when I traveled throughout the state last summer talking about the Natural Resource Trust Fund and going through all these different communities throughout all of Michigan and hearing the importance of trails and how trails are like the next big thing, I believe, in the state. And if we can connect them all, I mean, we're going to have people moving all over Michigan through trails, whether it be biking, hiking, or even the motorized trails. And it's something that we should definitely be proud of.
Very familiar with the TART trails up in Traverse City on the Leland Peninsula. I mean, they're just fabulous. And just imagine connecting all the different trails like that throughout the state. I mean, it's going to draw people to Michigan. It's going to be truly a major feather in the cap for pure Michigan.
Oh, absolutely.
Other things that your committee, the Natural Resources Committee, will be looking at over the next few months?
Over the next few months, we have a few issues. The biggest issue that we're working on right now is in regards to the beneficial use bill. And we had been referring to it as the unicorn bill because we figured we'd believe it when we seen it. Well, it was finally introduced, and it's something we're working on and making sure that If we have the opportunity to beneficially reuse certain materials that we can, such as different types of possibly like coal ash or wood ash, and using them in asphalt or concrete or land application, or even like the pulp from the paper mills. So it's a really unique concept. Right now, what these businesses are doing is they're just discarding of this stuff, like foundry sand, into landfills. Yeah. And it's just sitting there in a landfill. And if there is another beneficial use that's not, doesn't pose a threat or a hazard to the environment, why shouldn't we consider that? So that's something we're looking at right now.
Yeah, it really opens up opportunities for entrepreneurs. We're talking to people all the time that are looking at more sustainable ways of doing things. Why not take some of that landfill material? We're talking about doing it with a lot of other. So why not industrial waste?
Right. And it's, you know, it's just something that really needs to be considered. And we all know that the roads are a huge problem here in Michigan that are going to need to be addressed fairly soon. So, and possibly allowing these materials to be used, it could aid in that process of fixing Michigan roads.
Yeah, the infrastructure question, that we might have to hold that for another time. But that's one. You talk to most people in Michigan. I'm sure you hear from your constituents as well. But the road thing really needs to get fixed.
Oh, absolutely. And I hope that in this, either the end of this term or maybe if I'm successfully reelected my last term, we will have a solution.
Well, on that optimistic note, I've been talking with State Representative Andrea LaFontaine from the 32nd District of Michigan. She chairs the very important House Natural Resources Committee. I know how busy the DNR is. I can only imagine how busy your Natural Resources Committee has been and will continue to be. Thank you so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, Greening Mid-Michigan is comprised of several organizations committed to sustainable land use planning. The Greening Mid-Michigan team has just released a new DVD that highlights green infrastructure success stories. And here to tell us about the video and about Greening Mid-Michigan is Harmony Gamazel, the senior planner for the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. Harmony, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First, before we get into this fantastic video, and I did spend a good deal of time taking a look at it, at all four segments, give us a little bit of a snapshot on Greening Mid-Michigan.
Greening Mid-Michigan has been around for quite a while now. It's made up of a team of community leaders involved with habitat protection, farmland preservation, park and trail planning, and physical activity, getting people active and outdoors using our parks and trails. And so for a long time now, we've been promoting all sorts of fun activities related to those. Not fun and policy related. We try to engage community and community groups and residents and getting involved, but also we like to engage our policymakers, adopting policies related to land use that promote these ideas of green infrastructure in mid-Michigan. So it's been a matter of holding workshops and doing some mapping, reaching out to government groups, reaching out to community groups. We've been running all around with getting our message out there that we need to promote green infrastructure in mid-Michigan, particularly Eaton, Clinton, and Ingham counties. And so this video is really just a nice showcase of what we've been doing and what needs to happen next as far as more of this implementation.
Well, let's talk about this video. And again, it's very entertaining and very informative. You feature four different areas. You get into agriculture, active lifestyles, stormwater protection, and parks and things of that nature. Let's take them one at a time. Let's start with some of the parks and recreation facilities in the Tri-County area.
We have a very impressive network of not only local parks, you know, you're talking your townships, villages, and cities in our region, but the county parks are what we wanted to highlight in particular because some of these jewels that we have that are owned by the county were taken from old gravel pits and excavation sites and made into the most incredible public recreation assets that we have. You know, we're talking Hog Island in Lansing, Ingham County Park, the Lincoln Brick Park for Eaton County, which is outside of Grand Ledge, and the Moats Park north of St. John's. So they all have that in common. They came from industrial sites, and they've made them into these jewels that we can now use. And we wanted to highlight that and get that word out there that this can be done, and it's an incredible success story.
The one that I was not familiar with, and which was rather fascinating, the Lincoln Brick Park out in Grand Ledge, which also includes some historical preservation.
Yeah, that's near and dear to my heart, with an interest in historic preservation of built structures. And so, yes, that was an old limestone quarry. So there is a swimming area from the quarry itself, and there's also remnants of the factory that they're maintaining. They're not preserving it back to the way it was, but they're just maintaining it as it looks today. So it's very historic and rustic and very woodsy out there, too. It's beautiful.
Related to the fun things at the parks, active lifestyles, what about all the trails around here, the Lansing River Trail, et cetera? It seems to fit right into Governor Snyder's initiative of making Michigan, the most extensive, interconnected, trail-friendly state in the United States?
Well, mid-Michigan has a jump on that.
Well, let's talk about some of those trails.
Well, the Lansing River Trail is really the trail hub of our three counties. It all starts with that Lansing River Trail, miles of trail. And so what we're seeing now are the communities surrounding Lansing are trying to link up to that. Delhi Township and Holt from the south, they are even putting a trail under the freeway to go north up and connect to the Lansing River Trail. So that's quite a success story. We're looking at Williamstown Township and the Williamston area through Meridian also connecting from the east to the River Trail. I know that Delta Township and Lansing Township to the west want to link up. And of course, from St. John's down through Clinton County, we want to connect to the Lansing River Trail with a system of trails through DeWitt Township. So a lot of activity going, a lot of grant money flowing right now in our region to make those connections happen. And it's all to get people out there and active, not only for fun, but to commute daily using these trails from home to work.
I'm talking with Harmony Gamazel, the senior planner for the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. We're talking about a new Greening Mid-Michigan video, a very compelling and entertaining video, I might add. Another area that you feature in the video, Harmony, is agriculture, particularly farm markets.
Yes, well, our region is mainly rural, of course, as you see in the video. And then we wanted to highlight not only the operations of those farms being agriculture, environmentally sensitive, as far as the placement of fertilizer and such to make sure that we protect our environment with farming through our farming practices, because that's critical. So that piece is in there. But also the farmers markets. We really want to see a greater connection between local farmers and the farmers markets. That seller to purchaser connection. We want more of those strong connections. We wanted to highlight that so many of our smaller farms are the main, they are the basis of our farmers markets, and they really, it's an incredible network that we have, and we just want to create awareness about that and get more people out there to buy locally.
You know, just a couple of weeks ago, we talked to the sustainability director down at the University of Michigan, and his name is Don Scavia, and they have a goal there that they've already hit of purchasing 20% of their food on campus from sustainable sources, including local farm markets. Michigan State University has similar goals. Do you see these farm markets continuing to prosper and flourish in the tri-counties?
Greening Mid-Michigan does. We do see them flourishing and becoming more prevalent because we see farmers markets popping up in the out county areas. Not only are the farmers markets in the greater Lansing area strengthening, but we're seeing more new markets pop up around outside of the greater Lansing area, you know, Charlotte, St. John's, Mason.
Let's talk about the fourth area we have, and we don't want to neglect that at all. That's stormwater protection. Why stormwater protection is one of the four key elements of the video?
It's absolutely a key element. One of our strongest partners is the Greater Lansing Regional Committee for Stormwater Protection, and this is a group made up of many governmental and school district entities that work together to just keep their stormwater clean, and if it's not clean, clean it before it gets to our waterways. They have a pollutionisn'tpretty.org website you can visit that's amazing and brand new. And so because of their involvement on the Greening Mid-Michigan team, their efforts of putting in rain gardens, promoting a pervious pavement, all of these elements you can do with that are known as officially green infrastructure, in order to cleanse our rainwater before it reaches our waterways. That's a critical piece of greening in mid-Michigan. So that's why you see that segment in there.
Well, we've got about a minute left, Harmony. When can people expect to see the video? I know it's going to be aired on a number of public stations, public television stations, but people can also look at it online.
They can look it online. We have a Greening Mid-Michigan YouTube channel, which is easy to find. And during Earth Week in April, you'll be seeing the video in its entirety, the four segments all together, airing on WKAR, WCMU, and a couple other access channels around the state.
So what perfect timing as we move into Earth Week, and obviously very well planned for that launch.
And hopefully we'll see some greening happening and not so much whitening as with the snow.
Green will come, Harmony. Tell me it will come. From the perspective of Greening Mid-Michigan, there will be green in Mid-Michigan soon, right?
We'll make sure of that, yep.
Well, I've been talking with Harmony Gamazel, and she is the senior planner for the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. The Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, along with other entities, supports the Greening Mid-Michigan Initiative. Harmony, so great having you on the program, and continued success.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, my next guest is well-known tourism researcher, and she's going to give us a take on how the industry will fare in 2014. She is Dr. Sarah Nichols. She's an associate professor in the MSU Department of Community Sustainability and in the Department of Geography. And she, along with her colleague Dan McColl, recently provided a 2014 tourism industry prognostication up in Traverse City. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah, what are some of the highlights for 2014, as you and Dan, your research has shown?
Well, what we think for 2014 is that we'll see another sustained, steady growth in the tourism industry. Obviously, back in 2008 and 2009, the tourism industry, like the entire economy, was suffering. We saw some double-digit declines in the various metrics that we look at. Starting in 2010, we saw very strong recovery, double-digit increases in some of the key metrics. For the last couple of years, we've seen smaller increases in the 2 to 4% range. But in the long term, those kinds of numbers are much more sustainable. So we're really thinking in the 2 to 4% range in terms of the number of people traveling and the amount they're spending, which is obviously the important measure as far as impact on the economy.
Before we take a look at inside some of those numbers you just mentioned, how is it that you and Dan go about doing this research?
Well, it's a lot of work, a lot of data collection, and the thoughts and insight of a lot of industry leaders around the state. We start by gathering a lot of data about how the tourism industry fared in the previous year. We look at a range of factors that might have influenced travel across the year, from the weather to traffic counts, airport and bridge activity, of a slew of economic factors, gas prices, consumer confidence.
You even look at the stock market as one of
your variables, we look at the stock market exchange rates, housing activity and sales, employment rates. So pretty much all of the different factors that can influence tourism activity. So we gather all of that together. We also look at current and emerging tourism trends, both here in Michigan, in the U.S., and internationally. And then we gather a group of about a dozen members of the industry from across the state and some different sectors, present all of the information, and come up with a shared vision of how we think the number of people traveling and the amount that they're spending will change for the coming year.
And I know the tourism industry and a lot of other folks in Michigan look forward to those research reports every year. You mentioned trends that you look at. One mentioned in your report something called authentic travel experiences. People are looking for those. What do you mean by that?
What we mean by that is that people increasingly are valuing experiences over goods. So we're seeing, especially in light of the recession, and some people lost things. You know, they had cars and boats and RVs and houses
and
repossessed.
Cottages up north,
yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think people have reprioritized their lives and realized that things can be taken away, but experiences and memories can never be taken away. Once you have a good memory and a good experience, that's yours to keep forever. And I think especially for in the family market, we're seeing people looking to travel together and have experiences that they can enjoy together and remember together.
As unique experiences.
Absolutely.
And not so much the cookie cutter kind
and
of
And absolutely. Experience. People looking for something different and something that is unique and special to the place that they're visiting. So not the traditional chain or branded shop or hotel, but somewhere that's unique, run by local people with local insight that really gives them a flavor of that place, whether it's in terms of the architecture, the landscape, and especially here in Michigan, the foods and drinks. So we're really emerging as a culinary destination.
My guest is Dr. Sarah Nichols. She's an associate professor in the MSU Department of Community Sustainability and in the Department of Geography. And her research is funded in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research. Sarah, another trend, green amenities. Are young people, old people like me, or middle-aged people, are they looking for sustainable sorts of environments or venues to travel to?
I think that's a trend that we'll begin to see emerge more steadily in Michigan and the U.S. as a whole in the future. I think other parts of the world are leading the way in that area currently. But I think as more and more people realize that the resources that they enjoy are not limitless, they will begin to think more about how they can travel and with a little bit less of a footprint.
And as we were talking before we started the interview, places like Crystal Mountain and the Grand Hotel, there are venues in Michigan that have been on that track for quite some time now.
Absolutely. We have some leaders. The spa that was recently developed at Crystal Mountain was the first LEED certified spa in the Midwest. There's a property in Holland called City Flats, which was the first gold LEED certified property in the Midwest, and they just opened a second property in Grand Rapids. So we have some leaders, and I think that's something that is going to catch people's attention more in the future. And obviously we have the wonderful natural resources here to really back up The claim of being an eco-friendly destination.
Yeah, now all the governor's emphasis on connecting the trails and a lot of the work of the DNR and the Bell, there's so many things going on in Michigan that would conduce to that.
And absolutely, and all of that emphasis on our environment, of course, ties in very nicely with the whole Pure Michigan campaign.
Absolutely.
And pure can be interpreted as meaning authentic, but it can also be interpreted as sort of our pristine, clean, and bountiful natural resources.
From a standpoint of a researcher and somebody who looks at this objectively, is that Pure Michigan campaign and the resources provided, has that been as successful as it appears to have been?
It really has, and there are very solid economic data to back that up. For last year, for 2013, the return on the investment on that Pure Michigan campaign was $6.66.
Wow.
So for every dollar that the state spent, the state treasury received $6.66 back. So that doesn't even include other kinds of income for local entities. So I'm sure if we had a chance to invest in that, every single one of us would be
investing every dime. I
was just going to say, Sarah, I wish all my
investors like that. $6 for every dollar invested, not too bad. Let's drill down into the numbers a little bit you and Dan came up with. 1.5% more tourists who will spend 4.5% more money. Where are those 1.5% more tourists going to come from? What demographic do you think?
Well, the real focus of the Pure Michigan campaign for the last couple of years has been on our out-of-state visitors, especially out of our regional market. So people in Tennessee or Georgia or Florida, Texas, especially the southern states, I think, where their summers are a little bit too hot to handle. In many cases, I lived in central Texas for 5 years, and it's horribly hot and humid in the summer. So one of the key foci has been the golf market. There's a lot of golfers in the southern states.
Yes.
And, you know, it gets to about 11 o'clock in the morning in the summer. It's too hot down there. Up here in Michigan, 70 degrees, 80 degrees. It's perfect golfing summer.
So it's kind of a flip where the affluent snowbirds go south for the winter. The affluent Sunbelt folks come north for the summer?
Absolutely, and we'd like more of them to come. So that's sort of the most rapidly growing market right now. The new emphasis of the Pure Michigan campaign, of course, is on the international traveler. So for this current year, Travel Michigan is spending an additional $2 million on marketing in Ontario. And for the first time ever, we'll be advertising in Toronto. Toronto is a tremendously lucrative or potentially lucrative market.
Absolutely.
It's a big market. It's a little bit bigger
Very
than Chicago.
Yes.
A little bit wealthier than Chicago.
Right.
So a lot of potential to get all of those folks from Toronto into the state and enjoying what we have.
Sarah, we got about a minute left, but there are a couple of caveats to this sort of optimistic prognostication. What are a couple of things that could mitigate some of these numbers?
There's always a few things that, of course, we can't predict. One would be the weather, and whether the weather will cooperate or not. And we have some concerns about whether the cold winter that we've just had might affect the temperatures in the summer in terms of the freezing on the lakes and whether they'll warm up quickly enough to bring visitors here in the summer. Gas prices are always a concern. And of course, then any completely anticipated economic or military or terrorist kind of event that we simply couldn't predict but could have impacts
are always
regionally, nationally,
the
or internationally.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, I've been talking with Dr. Sarah Nichols. She is a tourism researcher at Michigan State University. She and her colleague Dan McColl recently provided a 2014 tourism industry prognostication at the Pure Michigan Governors Conference up in Traverse City. That report is available online. I imagine it could be Googled as well, huh, Sarah?
Absolutely.
And that's the name of the game is Google these days.
It is indeed.
Sarah, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
A few years ago, there was a lot of hyperbole about how Michigan was going to become the automotive battery production hub of the United States and how thousands of jobs would be created in the process. Well, let's fast forward to right now and a sobering article written by my next guest. He is Nathan Bomey, Detroit Free Press business writer. The article, Michigan Battery Companies Fall Short of Jobs Claims. Nathan, always good to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Give us an update on the Michigan Battery story.
Well, Michigan Battery Companies, that was quite the, like you said, there was a lot of hype surrounding this industry about 4 or 5 years ago, and for good reason. There was a thought that the electric vehicle would really revolutionize the automotive supply chain and would create a new opportunity for battery companies to start building lithium-ion battery cells and battery packs to supply to these electric vehicle makers. That would include companies like GM and Ford, and then even startup companies that were harboring hopes of making EVs at the time, but you know, we shoveled a lot of incentives, state and money and federal money into these companies, four major projects that we can talk about. And now if you take a look at it, though, 4 or 5 years later, you know, there just has not been that many jobs created, and there are many reasons you can blame, and it's not to say that jobs couldn't come in the future, but it certainly looks like the Michigan battery industry is has fallen quite short of what they had hoped to create at this point.
Well, before we look at the four entities, the four companies, let's talk about some of those reasons. Clearly, one reason it's fallen short, as you mentioned, has to be demand for the Chevy Volt and other electric vehicles.
Yeah, you know, the Chevrolet Volt was, you know, introduced as the first semi-electric vehicle in the country, and, you know, it has certainly been successful from the perspective of, you know, that first offering, and oftentimes the first one is the hardest, and they're selling about 1,000 to 2,000 units a month, so it has found an audience, but the price has only come down about $5,000, and that has kept the barrier pretty high for a lot of families who can't necessarily afford it, and the reason the price as high as because the battery costs are still high. And until those battery costs come down, electric vehicles are not going to be that popular because, you know, most people are still going to make a cost value, you know, analysis when they buy a car. And if the electric vehicle is too expensive and they aren't saving enough gas to make up for the extra cost, they just aren't going to make that purchase in many cases. So the Volt has not been that successful, and you haven't seen that many other electric vehicles pop onto the market except for recently Tesla Motors out of California, which is starting to have some success.
The Tesla model that you mentioned out in California may end up in retrospect being a more viable model of developing a battery industry than trying to pick winners and losers like we did in Michigan.
Yeah, Tesla started with the luxury electric cars, and that looks like it was the right path because they were able to price these vehicles very expensive, between about $70,000 and $110,000 for the Model S sedan, which is their main model. And, you know, this is a car that can get range of up to 300 miles on a single charge of electricity. Now, they're doing a much different thing with the batteries. They've got these small sort of double A-style cylindrical batteries in comparison into more of a rectangular pouch style that you see in the Chevrolet Volt. And this small batteries style that that Tesla has used is looking like a better option, at least for now, because, you know, many consumer electronics companies use those types of batteries. And so the industry is familiar with it. They're making them. They've driven the cost down. And there's enough supply for now, at least, to get Tesla's vehicles on the road. So Tesla has had a lot of success, and now they're considering making a gigafactory, which is essentially a 10 million square foot battery factory in the southwest United States, where they would employ up to 6,500 people to start making more batteries as they expand.
Now, I think I need to ask this question in fairness to what we tried to do in Michigan, but has Tesla received any R&D money from the state or federal government parallel to what happened in Michigan, or has it all been private investment?
No, that's a great question. They did receive a $465 million loan from the federal economic stimulus pot back in 2009, and that gave them a big boost in their early years. And, of course, they have also benefited from electric vehicle incentives, including they have this complex model in which they're able to sell credits to companies in California that are not making electric vehicles, because California has standards. They require you to have a certain number of alternative powertrain vehicles on the road, and Tesla has benefited from that. So they have certainly got a big boost from government money. However, at this point going forward, Tesla's model is more or less free of government cash, and they are succeeding as a private company. And the question is, though, can they ultimately introduce an affordable electric car? Because the luxury car has been successful. But Elon Musk, the founder, says he will introduce an affordable electric sedan within 3 years. And GM has also said the same. So there's a bit of a race here, and we'll see who gets there first.
My guest is Nathan Bomey. He is a business reporter for the Detroit Free Press. We're talking about Michigan battery companies. His article, Michigan Battery Companies Fall Short of Job Claims. Nathan, I'm a proud owner of a Chevy Volt, and I've been very, very happy with the car over the past 2 years, but I couldn't agree with your assessment more. Until that price point comes down and until that battery range increases, there are going to be some major barriers to adoption, particularly among younger people who would be inclined to buy the car for environmental reasons.
Yeah, and I think, you know, quality of the Volt is high, and there have been very few concerns. In fact, customer satisfaction of Volt owners is very high, so I don't think that's an issue at all, like you say. I think that the problem is that the battery companies that are making batteries for electric cars have been unable to get the cost down so far. We thought that by putting money into companies like A123 Systems and LG Chem and Johnson Controls Saft and Dow Kokam would help to reduce the battery cost, but what has happened is they built these big plants, but the cost has not come down. And that has led many experts to say that what is really needed is a breakthrough in the technology, like a breakthrough in the laboratory, and that has not quite happened yet. There are many good companies, though, that are working on those types of advancements. For example, a company in Ann Arbor called SOCT3, which is a University of Michigan spinoff, and they've received $30 million in investment for a next-generation electric vehicle manufacturing technology. So there is a lot of promising research out there that could eventually help reduce the cost so that electric vehicles are affordable.
Yeah, the CEO of that company, SOCT3, Anne-Marie Sastry, has been on our program. I think she also doubles as a University of Michigan professor, if memory serves me.
Yeah, Anne-Marie Sastry is viewed as a visionary in the battery field and has actually gotten investment from some major players such as General Motors Ventures, that's the GM venture capital arm, and Kosla Ventures out of California, which is one of the world's leading clean tech investors. So, you know, there is a view that this solid-state battery technology that they're working on could be a better answer than the current liquefied, you know, battery technology, to put it simply. So, you know, if we can develop a new manufacturing technology that does reduce the cost, then you could see wider adoption. And the question would be, is the unused capacity at our battery plants right now, would that be used up, or would it just sit there? Because the technology would be different, so those plants would have to adapt to the new technology.
You know, for people who want to get an update on those four companies that you mentioned, A123 Systems, LG Chem, Johnson Controls, Saft, and is it Dow Kokum, you did a nice job in your article. I guess the question, though, that sort of a, maybe a concluding question, looking back at the way Michigan did it and how the Granholm Administration and the Economic Development Corp went about incentivizing these companies and the federal government as well, what should Michigan, in your opinion, have done differently?
Well, the good news for Michigan is that much of the incentives were structured so that the state did not actually pay out some of these incentives. The incentives were structured so that you had to create jobs to actually get the money. So that was a good thing. But I think that there's a general consensus that had the state put a little bit more money into early stage companies that were sort of still developing the right technology instead of building the capacity before the demand was there, that there may have been more success. And of course, the federal government put nearly $1 billion into this technology as well, and that has not had much of an impact aside from the Tesla investment. So I think that oftentimes it's tough to pick a winner when the technology is still at the early stage.
I've been talking with Nathan Bomey, Detroit Free Press business reporter. You can follow Nathan on Twitter as at Nathan Bomey. That's B-O-M-E-Y. You can also follow him in the Free Press. Nathan, always great reading your stuff, and let's stay in touch. A lot more things to talk about going forward. Maybe the battery situation in Michigan will be a little bit brighter as in the months ahead.
I think the good news is that the battery companies in Michigan still have a few hundred employees, and they can adapt to the market as it changes. So there is some hope, and I appreciate you having me on.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
I'm Russ White for the MSU Department of Radiology and MSU Health Team. Mary Thiel is a physical therapist and manager of MSU's Rehabilitation Medicine Clinic.
We are ancillary services to physician services. So there's physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and psychology services, as well as lymphedema treatment. Lymphedema is swelling in the interstitial tissues. The program began as out of need for treatment of women in particular, status post breast surgery, mastectomies, lumpectomies, and lymph node removal, and they develop swelling in an extremity or in their chest or elsewhere. And it's a program that combines manual lymph drainage, so it's a type of a massage, along with teaching bandaging and fitting a custom compression garment. And it's fairly significant, the work that they do. It's expanded to where not only are they treating post-mastectomy, but any sort of swelling, whether it be post-operative, bilateral low extremity swelling because of complex chronic conditions. It's really quite a service to mid-Michigan and to the immediate community as well. The results are short of miraculous.
It's all about teamwork at the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic and the MSU Health Team.
We have an excellent relationship with MSU Sports Medicine, as well as the rest of the MSU Health Team. And we get anything from sports injuries to neurological disorders, persons with injury, whether it's central or peripheral. And we try and tailor that specific rehabilitation to that person's needs. So we have therapists who have niches. So we have therapists who specialize in sports medicine, post-operative care. We have therapists who specialize in manual skills, so spine. And we have specialists who work more with rehabilitation type traditional neurological insults, Parkinson's, any sort of dystrophy. So it's quite an eclectic environment, which makes it fun and interesting for everyone. And I think the different patient populations kind of inspire one another. Our occupational therapists and our neuropsychologists, they have developed a program for cognitive retraining, which is especially relevant with the more head injuries that we're seeing, more concussions we're seeing in athletes, the persons coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to treat these intermediate brain injury issues where they might be diagnosed with a concussive disorder, but they're not getting treatment. They're healing, so their pain is gone, but when they get into an area where they need to focus their attention, they're unable to do so. And they've developed a program in order to retrain those processing functions. It's really, again, another fascinating aspect of this practice that we're a part of. So we get inspiration from each other, whether we're specialists in neurology or we're specialists in spine or we're specialists in orthopedic, we can draw from one another to have optimal outcomes. In terms of our larger department, what's wonderful about it is there's such a good relationship with sports medicine, with radiology, with nutrition, and with rehab that we're able to provide better care for our patients because we know that sports medicine physician. We know the radiologist who looked at your X-ray or your MRI. We can refer you for your nutritional needs, and it makes preventative care better. It makes outcomes longer lasting. Without sounding too kitschy, kind of our motto is educate, engage, and empower. And we all strongly believe in that we want the patient to take an active role in their care. And once we can educate them and show them the techniques to improve themselves, they're now empowered to go ahead and have better health. So it's a great relationship. It's wonderful to work with all these professionals.
MSU's Mary Thiel explains the difference between physical therapy and occupational therapy.
Physical therapy is more what we call gross motor skills, so your larger movement. So, for example, we'll take a runner. They come in with knee pain. So we take a look at their strength, their range of motion, some special tests, how their core is, then put them on the treadmill. How are you running? Can you run? What are their asymmetries between right and left sides? How they're loading through as they're jogging or running? And then divvy that out into a program that's tailored to that client's needs and then continue to reevaluate so that they can achieve their goals. Occupational therapy usually deals with a little bit more fine motor skills. It's not just hands. Usually it is some upper extremity stuff, but in addition to upper extremity treatment, hands, our occupational therapist, like I said, does some cognitive retraining, sensory perception skills and drills, as well as activities of daily living. So if someone's having a difficulty with dressing, or they would need to get in and out of a car, or they need energy conservation, they might see our occupational therapist to evaluate those needs as well.
Mary Thiel says the mission of the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic is to help its patients to not just survive, but to thrive.
Our mission is to enhance the health of the community, to help them rebound after any sort of injury, whether it's cognitive or more musculoskeletal. One of our neuropsychologists like to say it's not just about surviving, it's about thriving and trying to get individuals to value what they're doing and how they're moving through space so they can get to that point where they're not just surviving, but thriving. And that's what goes on here. It's a very upbeat environment. There is a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm for what we do. We like establishing that relationship with patients. We get better outcomes that way as well. So anyone from myself as the clinic manager to our reception area, we like to see and hello and greet people and how are you doing and like to see that progress. It's not only satisfying for the patient and client, it's truly satisfying for us. We really enjoy recovery and staying healthy.
Please visit the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic online at rehab.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at spartanpodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.